You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the meeting grounds for spirituality and society, religion and culture.
Welcome to Expanding Horizons. I'm Jenny Dyster and I'm with Jacqueline Stewart.
Today we're discussing detective stories and their significance in how we make meaning in life.
I've lost count of the number of detective stories I've read, beginning, I guess, at the age of 13 or so, and never neglected for more than a month at a time since.
Well, some people reflect on books that they say give meaning to their life. I find that detective stories are high on the list of books that give meaning to my life.
That's interesting, because detective stories are often regarded as airport reading, very lightweight.
Yes, but some books set out to tell you how to make meaning in your life. They tell you what to think and how to approach life. But detective stories, to me, are more interesting and effective, because they demonstrate what can happen if your thoughts take you in a particular direction. There is a result to reflect on, as well as an involvement in considering what might happen.
Now, I find detective stories extraordinarily satisfying, both emotionally and intellectually. It's not just that the puzzle is solved, but there's a sense of psychological close that's almost addictive, and that's fascinating.
Also fascinating is that detective stories give you a sense of the society you're living in. Over the past 150 years or so, since the genre has really been established, there's a real change in the way that detective stories reach out to the reader, and a change in the way that the stories look at problems in life.
It's quite surprising how many current detective writers, who are living in a very secular world, have a theological background or theological theme to their writing. Some of the authors have theological degrees, and others have characters who are clerics.
And some authors create very hard-boiled detectives who spend a lot of time thinking about what it all means. And I'm thinking particularly about a character called Matt Scudder in the novels of Lawrence Block. This character tithes. He gives 10% of all the income from his crime solving to church poor boxes because he feels that somehow this will make things all right.
It sounds as if he has something on his conscience.
Well, perhaps we all do, and that's what sparks our interest in crime solving. Most of us from time to time feel we want to make the world better, and probably most of us from time to time feel that we haven't. As for this particular character, he used to be a cop, but quit the police force because one of his bullets, which was aimed at a robber, ricocheted and killed a child. So his conscience is very troubled. He meant to wound a criminal, but wounded himself.
Now that, of course, is a specific type of character, the wounded child. I've been reading about these archetypes recently. I'm thinking of the warrior, for example, the searcher, and of course there's the wounded child.
Yet this is supposedly a hard-boiled modern detective who's the wounded child. He's acting out the tough role, but underneath he's hurting. It's this kind of demonstrated contrast that gives detective stories a layer of real meaning, for me, under the top layer of the whodunit.
Well, now there's even an archetype who's called the detective. It might be interesting at this point to look at the characteristics of the detective and the shadow detective, because in all of us there are two voices. Now, the archetype of the detective is someone who combines great powers of observation with highly evolved intuition and logic. This person can solve problems, including crimes, thereby earning great respect. By contrast, the shadow detective is a snoop.
So, in a detective story, you can have the real detective and the informer.
The informer is the shadow side or the downside of the detective. This is the neighbour peeping out from behind blinds, or the shady police informer, or the spy. These characters pop up for detectives like Miss Marple, but these are the people who make it possible for information to be falsified or sold to the highest bidder. They can be driven by self-righteousness or greed.
Well, we were talking about detective stories giving meaning to real life. In a crime novel, the informer is always second rate. The shadow is naturally the dark. It's a sort of added sense of evil. In the early detective stories, the idea of the informer wasn't even included. People either blundered into giving out the necessary information, or they were generally happy to help an investigation along, doing their duty or doing their best.
Yes, like that awfully nice ladies, and sometimes gentlemen, who were more than happy to give Sherlock Holmes the benefit of their observations, in the interest of fair play. He never had to pay anybody.
Things have changed in our culture and in the crime culture. The detectives of today don't isolate themselves from crime and then contrive solutions through the efforts of concentrating their little grey brain cells.
Yes, well, the detective of today is rarely the archetypal warrior sort of detective. Inspector Dalgleish is an exception. He's almost a white knight. He's a poet and a policeman, and he basically lacks any character flaws.
Yeah, but he doesn't round up the suspects in the library and make a triumphal display of uncovering the murderer. And I think that this isn't just because readers are tired of this, but maybe because writers don't want to write about it. It doesn't reflect what's going on. It used to be that it was okay for the detective to be the authority, someone who was relatively uninvolved about what was going on in the world, and who just came out of his office to make an heroic bust, sort of like a high priest coming out at sunrise.
We still enjoy a surge of nostalgia, though, a glance back in black and white, when the sleuth brings the villain to justice.
The theme from Peter Gunn. I used to watch that television series in black and white, which seems appropriate because the old vinyl scratches on the record give it that special quality. Peter Gunn always got the criminal before the final commercial.
Setting the world to rights is not something that's generally achievable in our lives. But in that sort of story, the audience has the satisfaction of seeing wrongdoers receive their comeuppance. It's pipe dream stuff, and we see it over and over again without objecting to the repetition, because at some level, it is psychologically satisfying.
Yes, it is. But there's another dimension, I think. Sometimes we want the villain to get brought to justice, but other times we identify with the villain and want them to get away with their crime. And sometimes we, as the reader or the audience, like to have it both ways, which makes me think of the saint.
Da 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 da.
I think that's exactly right. There's a lot of mockery in those notes. You know there's a trick or a twist coming. With Peter Gunn's music, you know there's going to be some heavy gumshoeing. But with the saint, you can expect that the detective himself might be a little bit light-fingered if there's any boodle, and you don't begrudge him a financial reward that would otherwise end somewhere in the public coffers, because he's done the job that the public servants should have done.
Well, we know that we live in an uncertain world. There are no special rules about what's fair. Justice is not necessarily done, nor seen to be done.
That uncertainty could be seen as a license to do whatever you can get away with.
Well, this certainly came out at the end of the 20th century in crime novels and television dramas.
That crime writing reflected the social order.
Well, I guess that's why the crimes are becoming increasingly nasty and the tactics employed to solve them more and more ruthless. And this is what, I guess, bothers me about some of the more lurid telemovies. They seem to me to feed into a climate of fear.
There's also a climate of confusion. I know that confusion sounds a bit odd because we have so much more information at hand now, but it's also too much, really. We have so much choice. We hear one comment on radio, something a bit different on television, and then read a slightly different version of the same story in the morning paper. What is actually going on? If you don't know what's going on with a problem, how can you justify its solution? What's fair? What's right? Who should win?
Well, they're questions about values. So it's probably not surprising that quite a few detective story writers are interested in theology and religion.
Who comes to your mind first?
Well, P.D. James, I guess. And Laurie King, who has a detective who's a part-time detective and a part-time theologian with a Jewish background. But P.D. James uses her Anglican background to create crime scenarios and outcomes that are affected by her beliefs about the nature of evil, original sin, and redemption.
And Catholic writers use their characters to explore value systems.
Well, I can remember Father Camillo, who used to have conversations with God at the altar in the middle of his sleuthing.
Carrie Kemmelman discussed Jewish thought through his accidental detective, Rabbi David Small. And there are many writers who use clerics to solve mysteries. There's the historical character of Brother Cadfael and the modern Spanish priest, Father Lorenzo Cart, or the feng shui detective, and even from the 7th century, the historical figure Judge Di, who was a Taoist.
Yes. Well, using such characters makes it easy for the writers to address the problem of evil and also to critique the values of society. Judge Di, for example, has very clear rules about behavior, Confucian rules.
Well, Ma Ramotswe of Botswana or Isabel Dalhousie of Edinburgh, who are both creations of Alexander McCall Smith, both think a lot about what is the fair and proper thing to do in their situation.
I think what's important about these kind of characters is that they affirm a faith in the goodness of people and not the cynicism about the essential nature of people. Some of the crimes these characters investigate turn out to be not crimes at all.
That says a lot about our social instincts now. We seem to have become so used to seeing crimes everywhere that we just look on the dark side of human nature.
What a voice, eh? It's a bit chilling. It's Jane Sheldon who does the theme for the television series Silent Witness. And that's a program that I think is typical of the forensic detective story that verged on horror.
Ooh, that scream. I saw an episode of this. I felt it was more about creating fear than it was about looking at a mystery. I couldn't get any sense that the storyline was evaluating values like good and evil, which is what happens in a true detective story. It just exposed nasty nature versus helplessness in a cruel world, like a warning. Could this happen to you? Look out.
Well, the central character was attached to a love interest, which I suppose was to help make her more endearing. We all have our own stories of love, so that helped the audience identify with her. But then in later episodes, she was stalked and threatened by the serial killers she was investigating. It made the fearsomeness more immediate because the audience knew her vulnerability.
But this has little to do with real mystery or detection. It reflects the current culture of fear. It doesn't examine values.
Nor does it provide any comfort or any satisfaction.
No. But I guess we all need to live through a phase of life where standing at the edge of danger is important, and we need to read horror stories, whether they're fairy tales or myths or pop horror, or go to see films with indomitable aliens or crazed humans, and then check ourselves out to see if we're all right. But then we pass on to examining difficult or dangerous situations where there is an actual solution, not some coincidence that works out well for the main character. Focusing continually on fictional situations where there's no solution only leads to hopelessness or apathy.
The satisfaction is highly important to me when I read, detective stories especially. Now, I don't need punishment for wrongdoers, but I do need solutions. Solutions that come out after clearly spelled out puzzles and clues to sift and hunt and sort out.
That clue sifting is really useful to me too. I don't make a big point of trying to solve the mystery before it's revealed at the end, but I do pay attention to things that might be clues. And I think this is really important as a skill that develops from reading detective fiction. It gives you a wide background in the possibilities for solutions to problems and for random chance, or the possibility of other problems coming up as a result of what has already happened. And it also exposes you to the avenues of power in society.
Well, even in the Judge D mysteries, which seem to be quite remote from our time, the crimes relate to different levels of society and different avenues of power and influence. There's often a financial element, a political element, a legal element, sexual theme, and some connection to the religious institutions. So there's a mixture of high life and low life characters within a tangled web of interconnections.
Which takes us right up to the 21st century. Lots of people seem fairly taken aback at documentaries like Fahrenheit 9/11 or The Corporation, possibly because the information is densely packed. But I would guess that habitual detective story readers would not be affected in quite this way. You can pick up social clues every day in the newspaper. It's like going through a mystery. You sift through the problems that are emerging. You start to see where the power is going, and then you get stuck into sorting out the web, a web of tangled connections.
You don't expect your own life to be a simple narrative. You don't expect society to have a simple trajectory to move forward.
There are too many things that link together for events to move us in a straight line. And if we forget this truism, we can just look at our computer screens to remind us how many things are part of the cause and effect when we want to access information.
I wonder if conspiracy theories are partly due to a failure to develop the habit of looking for multiple links, as opposed to looking for a single cause, a single narrative line. It's much harder to find a prime mover if you accept that there are many trends in current events that converge and diverge all the time. And random chance can't be denied its place in everything from a tripping tap to an impending disaster.
Yes, there's always that chance. Even if we think we have all the clues in place, we can't always solve the mystery because there's the possibility of some surprise element coming in. But if we're aware that surprise or chance is just another link, we won't be fooled into thinking that our path is clear or our destination is obvious. And if we think about our own lives as being connected to society, actually think about it, we can see that an element that comes into our lives is social change. I don't think this ever surprises us because it's a gradual thing.
In fact, we probably don't notice it much until all of a sudden we can't do things the way we used to do.
But you really do notice it if you are a chronic reader of detective stories. When you pick up a book that was written even 20 years ago, you can see the different way that the detective operates. The early detectives, think of Sergeant Cuff, Sherlock Holmes, Hercule Poirot, Nero Wolfe, they operated from an intellectual and psychological distance. They solved crimes generally based on reasoning ability and practical police work, and then retired from the scene without a reflective comment.
They also retired, leaving the legal system to mop up. There was a faith in the probity of the system. It shows how, as a society, we used to depend on those with authority. The cop on the beat, the judge, the peer of the realm, the distinguished physician, the expert witness.
But then there was a switch to the detective who operated in a story that was a psychological exposé. This is when the hard-boiled detective came onto the stage, the wounded child we talked about.
And also the unofficial detectives, Miss Marple, Miss Pym. They rely more heavily on popular psychology than on physical evidence, and they reveal a lot about how society saw itself through the values of the writer, what the writer felt it was okay to say. No sex,
no
of course.
Sex.
No, no, but lots of snobbery. Eyebrows beginning low over the nose and ending high up at the outer end were for one such detective an indication of a scheming, conniving mind.
But the official detectives often operated by spending as much time examining their own minds as they did putting the clues into place. These detectives operated much closer to the crime milieu. They were more involved and more affected by what was going on around them. This was, and in many cases still is, an indication of how people looked at their own role in society. Maybe they needed to look at their own role because they felt they couldn't afford to stand back and let justice take its natural course.
Well, they didn't trust the course of justice. There was no longer any faith that justice would be done, or that there was any such thing as natural justice.
I read once that it's children who want justice, because they're innocent. Adults don't want justice. They want mercy.
I like that. Well, mercy for themselves, perhaps, not necessarily for anyone else.
But adults want to see that justice is done in the social order.
Oh, it's still a requirement for readers.
And a requirement for social order. People need social order. And recent detective stories reveal how uncomfortable things can get when it seems that the social order, the justice system, breaks down. This new generation of detective story is full of creeping crime. The detective is not only intellectually and psychologically connected to the crime, she or he actually gets caught up in it and can become one of the intended victims. That makes a grisly point about people and their expectation about the law enforcers. the people who are there to alleviate criminal activity are in no way protected from it.
Well, it's a loss of faith in goodness, in God, if you think in those terms. And some popular detective writers do include scenes in which the detective reflects upon the urgency of what has to be done, knowing all the time there's no walking away from it. The detective has to decide to do something quickly. No action could turn out to be worse than the wrong action, and people identify strongly with that dilemma.
But that dilemma, repeated over and over again, does induce a general fear, a sense of powerlessness. And in those creeping crime stories, the solution is often just the saving of the hero's life for the next novel or episode. There isn't a resolution, no crack investigation work leading to a solution. The ending is usually just a matter of coincidence or luck.
Those detectives are operating on shifting sands. They can't count on the legal system, their colleagues, their superiors, or the public.
What a mess.
Which is why I look for stories that are written by authors with a clearer set of values and more hope. A sense of humour doesn't hurt either.
All in all, the creeping crime scene lacks balance. Everything is suspicious. Nothing good is rewarded. Everyone spends their time looking for love in all the wrong places and being alarmed, not alert. So tiring.
Perhaps we're in the phase where the pendulum is about to swing back from gritty realism to a more imaginative world, a world with humanity, hope, compassion for weakness. The Full Cupboard of Life is the title of a contemporary detective story.
So is Visions of Sugar Plums. You talked about gritty realism. I've never had any sense of realism from the so-called realistic crime stories. My own world is full of groups of people who balance each other out. There's no tipping of the scales into communal darkness. We've talked today about learning from detective stories, and we haven't given much time to exploring the idea of reading stories to get outside our own problems. But sometimes those are both the same thing. We get outside our own problems to escape them, at the same time knowing that this will help us see our own problems more clearly. Usually, this means that our own problems aren't as big as we thought they were, and we gain a different perspective.
One of the dilemmas that many modern people have is that they have a negative experience of religion, or should I say formal religion, but they're drawn to tales which include spiritual matters. They want to see their problems addressed in a deeper and more imaginative way. And there's also a curiosity about religion, which you see reflected in the sales of such authors as Umberto Eco or Dan Brown.
Well, when we need to wrestle with our problems, we like to go to somebody who appears to be observant, a good listener, and someone who's not too expensive. In the old days, that would be a priest or a prophet. Today, it could be a mystery writer. Writers who show that they understand the human condition are very attractive to us. They demonstrate in their plots and their characters that they're experienced in looking at life, that they're considerate in their judgments of people who've made mistakes.
That sort of sensibility is more acceptable from a fiction writer than from a self-help book. This may be because when we're troubled, we're resistant to being told what to think or how to be.
I think people are more responsive to being shown what can be done than being told what to do. At the beginning of the program, I said that I read detective stories to help make meaning in life. I could have said to make meaning of life.
Detective writers need to do a lot of detailed research into the settings of their crimes, and because crimes can be set almost anywhere and any time, there's a richness of background information about almost every aspect of human life. So I'd like to end with a quote from the detective writer Lawrence Block. "If you want to learn about anything under the sun, you have only to read the right detective story."
And that's our episode of Expanding Horizons for the week. The introduction is a piece named Elements by the artist CDK. The piece is licensed under Creative Commons and can be found from a link on our media website. And be sure to visit our media website, unitariansa.wordpress.com. This is White Rabbit, out.